You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we talk to our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, who joins us to set the day's agenda from Tokyo. Fiona, what do you have for us today?
Well, the big news here is that John Kerry, US Secretary of State, is making his first visit to Japan. He's calming Japanese nerves over North Korea.
Also coming up, Croatians headed to the polls to elect their first ever members for the European Parliament. But how much do they really want to be part of the club?
We'll ask if the biggest global institutions are failing to keep up with the rest of the world.
And in this week's preview of Culture, we see if the music industry can put some magic back into the record store.
I think the really interesting thing with Record Store Day is that as it's grown and as it's got bigger, every year stores are kind of reporting record takings. You know, they take more on that day than they do the whole of December.
All that, plus we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
What a mouth-watering radio hour we have ahead of us. Hey, Phil.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And we'll get started, as ever, with the news headlines. Here's Paul Osborne.
Nicolas Maduro has been elected the next president of Venezuela. The man chosen by Hugo Chavez to be his successor won just under 51% of the votes. Venezuela's election commission says that result is irreversible. But Monocle's Irene Caselli, who's in Caracas, says the opposition candidate Enrique Capriles is unhappy.
He said that he's simply not going to accept the results of this vote. He said that so far their independent counting of the voting just doesn't match up with the official results that have been announced by the National Electoral Council.
On the day North Korea marks the anniversary of its founder's birth, the US is warning the country not to add to the tension on the Korean Peninsula. There are often displays of military strength on the anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, and there's been speculation that could mean another missile test. But U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the international community won't tolerate any further escalation.
One thing is certain. We are united. There can be no confusion on this point. The North's dangerous nuclear missile program threatens not only North Korea's neighbors, but it threatens its own people.
Activists in Syria say 11 civilians died when government forces bombed a Kurdish village in the north of the country. They say the raid happened near the village of Hadad in an oil-rich district of Syria. The Kurdish National Council, a group of Kurdish parties in Syria, says it's a serious escalation of hostilities by the regime. The slowdown in Europe and the United States has had a knock-on effect on the Chinese economy. While it still grew significantly in the first 3 months of this year, the figure, 7.7%, is below many analysts' predictions. China is hoping to boost growth after it fell to its lowest level in 13 years in 2012. Business analyst Leon Goldfield, though, says there are some optimistic signs.
Clearly, the Chinese economy has picked up from where it was in the first half of last year, and even in the third quarter, it's picked up quite strongly in the fourth quarter. The momentum is ebbing a little bit, but our expectation is that China can continue to grow around the 7.5% to 8% level, certainly for the next quarter and maybe even a quarter after that.
Voters in Croatia have been electing their first ever members of the European Parliament. 12 MEPs will take up their seats at the start of July when the country becomes the newest member of the European Union. It's the latest stage in a 10-year journey to membership. Government ministers in France will reveal details of their personal wealth today. It's a deadline set by the president, François Hollande, to release information about their finances. He's keen to restore public trust after the country's former budget minister was charged with tax fraud over a secret bank account. Ministers have been told to release details of bank accounts as well as property, cars and works of art. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
A Thank you very much, Paul. That could be an uncomfortable deadline, isn't it? Releasing all your works of art and how much money you've got and where it's all hidden away.
Worrying so, times.
Worrying indeed. It is 5 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in London. Paul, we'll be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world news headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
We are live from London, where it's 5 minutes past 8 a.m. And we start the show as ever with the agenda setter. Today, Monocle's bureau chief in Tokyo, Fiona Wilson, tells us the stories that she thinks we need to know about, at least for the following 24 hours. Good afternoon to you, Fiona. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Good afternoon to you. It's good morning, really, for you, isn't it?
It is. Thank you very much for reminding us. let's start with a very high-profile visitor, or in fact, one of two high-profile visitors, the first from Burma, though.
Oh, yes. Well, Aung San Suu Kyi is here. I mean, in a way, it's been slightly overshadowed by John Kerry's presence, but Aung San Suu Kyi is making her first visit to Japan in 27 years. She was actually a visiting scholar here before she went under house arrest. And this was in the 80s. She was a student at Kyoto University, and she's actually been there today speaking to students there.
And what's, Fiona, been the reaction of her visit? Has she had a rock star welcome?
Yeah, I mean, she's very, very popular here. I wouldn't say, I don't know if a rock star welcome, but I mean, you know, obviously she's hugely thought of. Japan had quite an interesting situation while Aung San Suu Kyi was under house arrest. They really engaged with the regime, which was unpopular in some quarters. And now they were actually Burma's largest creditor, and they wiped off a huge amount of debt at the beginning of the year. Taro Aso, the Japanese finance minister, was in Burma, and he was also losing the debt, but also offering a huge amount of low interest loans. And I think at this point, you know, Japan is very interested in investment. And, you know, obviously, Aung San Suu Kyi is here. It's partly a personal visit. She's a backbench MP. She's not a leader in any sort of political sense anymore. But she is obviously a huge figurehead. And I think, you know, people want to talk to her. So she'll be meeting with Fumio Kishida, who's the foreign minister, and maybe with Shinzo Abe, the prime minister.
So when we read that she's been talking about the need for Japan to show support to her homeland, what she's really talking about is trying to drum up investment then?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, I think, you know, Japan has for a long time had a huge interest in Burma economically. And I think now the opportunities are opening up. And obviously it's a bit of a bun fight. You know, all the countries in the region want to get in there. They can see huge potential.
And I understand there's been a bit of controversy, though, surrounding her visit. And this is regarding her refusal, I guess, to meet with about 200 members of the Rohingya minority community there in Japan. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, I'd like to know the backstory there. It's certainly reported in the press today that that there are 200 apparently Rohingya here, that they're not being welcomed. They're not being made part of the welcoming group. Obviously, every Burmese person who's in Japan wants to see Aung San Suu Kyi. It's an amazing opportunity for them. Most of those were refugees. They left under very difficult circumstances. And for some reason, the Rohingya are not welcome. And, you know, there's certainly been a fair amount of criticism of Aung San Suu Kyi that she hasn't spoken up for the Rohingya, that this Muslim minority who've really had a very hard time recently, particularly. And I think a lot of people feel she's been rather quiet on that subject.
Should we talk about the other high-profile visitor then? John Kerry, as we were hearing earlier on, is now on the ground. He's been doing a little bit of a tour of the region, presumably with one topic at the top of the agenda.
Yes, I mean, he's making a show of talking about a few other things like Okinawa, but basically this is all about North Korea. He's already been in Seoul, he's been in China, he's in Beijing, and now he's here. And he did a press conference yesterday, and he spoke this morning at the Tokyo Institute of Technology. I mean, yesterday was a press conference really about North Korea. Today he was talking a bit more about the American pivot, the pivot towards Asia that's been talked about for quite a long time, just about the slightly strategic rotation of their foreign policy towards Asia, which is very timely, as it turns out. But no, obviously it's very, very significant that he's here, you know, tensions are very high and there's a bit of a standoff at the moment, and it's not really clear how it's going to move forward.
And today is the anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, of course, the founder of North Korea. Many people anticipating that there could potentially be a missile test launch sometime today. What's the sense there in Tokyo where you are? Is there a growing sense of tension over when this missile test might happen?
Well, I mean, any big anniversary, you know, people are expecting a few fireworks. I don't really know. I mean, certainly there have been observations of missiles moving to the east coast of North Korea. You know, obviously Japan is within range of medium range missiles. It's really unclear how successfully North Korea can launch or how reliably they can launch missiles. So there's a certain unknown to the whole thing. I mean, yes, Japan is ready. It's got the anti-missile defense system up and ready should anything start. Already we're kind of at the, you know, it's the afternoon here. And, you know, everyone's following to see what's happening in North Korea, which mostly seems to be, you know, they had a marathon yesterday, lots of singing and dancing and flag waving, but no missiles firing just yet.
These words, tensions, ratcheting tensions, seem to be peppered in every report about the North Korea situation. I wonder, given that it's his first visit, did John Kerry deliver anything that sort of ratcheted down those tensions? Did he have any reassuring words about the situation?
I mean, I think honestly, there was no great sort of move forward in terms of policy. He's been very good at sort of, I think he's been going around the region basically saying that we want to talk, we want to negotiate. He has been trying to defuse the tension, I would say. He's not talking in any sort of belligerent way. I mean, the problem is at the moment that Kim Jong-un is in a bit of a corner, isn't he? You know, he's made all these threats, and now where's he going to go? And also, where is the US, which is really leading this whole thing, where's it going to go? You know, North Korea is saying we're not giving up nuclear weapons, not giving up our nuclear program. Everyone else is saying, well, we don't want you to have nuclear weapons. So at the moment, both sides are in danger of losing face. And I think it's just a case of scaling it all down slightly. It will have to be a very incremental decrease in the tension just to get to the table. I mean, that's what everyone wants. Start talking. And then at least if they could perhaps say nuclear weapons have to at least be on the table, just to get the talks going, and then things will start to move. But definitely, I would say tensions are no higher. I mean, of course, today is a particular anniversary, but you do feel that John Kerry has gone around very carefully to Seoul and Beijing, and now here with the same message, which is that we all are united, all the other parties, and we all want to talk.
And moving on, Fiona, to your third story that is setting the agenda today. Haruki Murakami released his latest novel over the weekend. I read somewhere like 200, 300 people lined outside a Tokyo bookstore at midnight waiting to get their copy. What's been the reaction been to his latest novel?
Well, I'm so interested in Murakami. You know, you think everything happens on a mobile phone these days, but it's quite reassuring to know that there was a print run of 500,000 for this book, and already it's been reprinted 3 times before it was even published, and since it was published on Friday, another 100,000 have been reprinted. So, you know, people are really interested in his work, and yeah, people were out on the street. You know, it always generates a lot of publicity. It's fantastic for the book industry when Murakami publishes a novel, and it was interesting that the report in the press today was that the music industry is getting a nice spin off because the main character in the book listens to a lot of Franz Liszt and some very particular piano suites, and they're anticipating huge sales of these piano suites on CD. So everyone's very delighted about that. So there's a sort of Murakami industry that has grown up.
Well, the heirs to Franz Liszt are clearly delighted, but is it any good? Are there any reviews out yet? What do people think?
You know, I haven't read any detailed reviews. It's interesting because I was having a look. So I'm thinking, well, what is the reaction? I mean, all the reaction has been from fans, which is obviously ecstatic. It does sound like classic Murakami territory, I have to say. It's about a man looking back on his slightly depressed past and his severed friendships. And Murakami really goes into these relationships. And it's the kind of thing that people expect from Murakami. And I think a music soundtrack, you know, Murakami himself is a big jazz fan. He's big on music. So that kind of connection with music, I think, is a classic Murakami touch as well.
Well, Fiona, you'll have to check back in with us and let us know what you think of the novel. That was Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief.
Coming up, Croatia has gone to the polls to elect its first European Parliament representatives. But what of the state of the economy ahead of the EU entry?
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Istanbul Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard, and just for a minute, give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here from Studio One at Midori House. It is with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It is 17 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in London. Now, the European Union should be welcoming its 28th member in July this year. Croatia will become the second of the former Yugoslav republics to join the club, following on from Slovenia earlier this year. Now, ahead of this change, the weekend saw the opening of the polls for Croatia's first European Parliament elections, where 12 candidates will be chosen from the estimated 40 political parties to represent the 40 million odd electorate.
But what will its membership mean for its former compatriots, Serbia, Bosnia, Montenegro and Macedonia? And what are the prospects for the EU given the torrid state of Croatia's economy? Well, to enlighten us, here's Rina Kula, an expert in southeastern Europe at the University of Uvascola in Finland. Welcome to Midori House. It's historically quite hard to get voters excited about European-level elections, certainly in this country at least. How excited were people? What was the turnout like?
Good morning. Well, in my opinion, in these elections, Croatia appears to be slightly progressive than an average European country. The voter turnout itself was very low. It was approximately 21%. And that is a figure that is quite close to numbers from Lithuania and Slovakia in the last 2009 Euro elections. I'm a little bit surprised that the turnout was that low, given that the turnout in the Croatian parliamentary elections was almost 62% in 2011, and in the EU referendum, 43%. Nonetheless, considering the average enthusiasm for EU EP elections, this was quite an average result, in my view.
And now let's talk about those results. It looks like Croatia's opposition right-wing coalition has won the most seats in the country. What can we learn from this result?
Well, I think it's actually quite interesting. Croatia seems very split down in the middle in the votes. The Christian Democratic Party, HDZ-led coalition, did win 32.87% of the votes, with 99% counted. And the Social Democratic Party, government-led coalition, won 32.08 votes. So it was very close, less than 1%. On top of that, the Labour Party won 5.76% of the vote. And this result then means that Croatia will be sending six MEPs who will be aligned with the EPP, Coalition of the Conservatives in the EP, and six MEPs who will be most likely aligned with the Socialist and Democratic Coalition in the EP. So for me, that's very interesting. It's very even, actually. And the other interesting fact is that Croatia will send six women and six men. And the other feature that I noted last night was that out of the candidates for the EP elections, the main coalitions had very few sports stars or other celebrities on the list that often feature quite prominently in the EP elections in other countries.
Okay, well, people taking things fairly seriously then, you would imagine. Let's talk about the economy, because it's had quite a lot of a bad press, this whole move, on account of the fact that Croatia could well be the recipient of a bailout before this July date even arrives. Is it reasonable to be as concerned as some nations seem to be about Croatia's economy?
I absolutely don't think it's reasonable to be concerned about the Croatian economy in that level. I think the Croatian average voter has to think about what is to his or to her benefit in electoral politics. But the average unemployment rate in Croatia in 2012 was 15.9%, which is not quite high. It's somewhat higher than the average in the EU or the Eurozone, which is 12%. But for Southern Europe, it's not the highest by any means. It is high in the history of the country. The last time the unemployment was that high was in the early 2000s. But I think that there is very little talk of a bailout.
You say that we shouldn't necessarily be worried about the economic status of Croatia, but, you know, unemployment has been rising. As you said, it's around 15.9% now. Two ratings agencies have downgraded the country's debt to junk status. Is Croatia really ready to join the EU at this time when things really across the continent seem to be so precarious?
I think that this is a crucial time for Croatia to join the EU, mostly for the fact that 63% of Croatia's foreign trade at the moment goes to the EU. When the country is a member of the EU, it will have much more influence in the economic and social policy of the Union, which already determines, even if Croatia wouldn't join, much of its economic possibilities. On top of that, there is always much talk of the amount of money that the EU structural and cohesion funds that are available would provide Croatia. They now stand at 1.5 billion a year, where at the same time Croatia would be obliged to contribute about 680 million a year to the EU budget. So the possibility for the funds is quite large. However, more important, I think, than the funds is the fact that Croatia's economy is such a structure that even if you look at the map, what can Croatia really bring into the EU is a large tourism industry and a coastline in Europe. To be part of a European Union will help the Croatian economy in several ways, not only in terms of providing funding for larger projects, but it will provide Croatia to have a closer relationship to the tourist industry and the tourist markets of Europe, but also possibly to serve as a transportation connection network between Southern Europe and Northern Europe. And this should all help the economy to develop, for example, service industries related to tourism as well.
Rina, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us this morning. Rina Kula from the University of Uvaskala in Finland. Many thanks indeed. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds and Phil Hahn. We'll be back with the author of a recently released work, Divided Nations, Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. That's coming up. Now, big institutions with vast global memberships, powerful enough to solve big international problems. The post-war plans for institutions like the IMF, the UN, and the World Bank were ambitious, but some six decades on, we're in a different world, a world of cybercrime, pandemics, and of global financial crises. So have the institutions kept up with the world around them?
Ian Golden is professor of globalization and development at Oxford University, and he's been considering exactly that question in his new book, Divided Nations, Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. He joins us now on the line. Ian, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Why have these global institutions failed us then, in your opinion?
Good morning, Dominique and Phil and your listeners. They failed us because they failed to keep pace with the momentous changes that have occurred in the world over the last 20 or so years, the fall of the Berlin Wall, ending of the Cold War, and the hyperconnectivity, which is both as a result of political and ideological opening up, but also technological breakthroughs, not least fiber optics and the internet, have led to a very different sort of world, a world of cascading risks and shocks that come across borders, and also many more people, 2 billion more people, improving their income. So the atmosphere, the oceans, and other global commons are under great pressure. And what we have is some issues like finance, where they were old institutions that, as the financial crisis has demonstrated, are unfit for purpose, and other institutions other issues like climate change or cyber, and international migration as well, where there's simply no institutions. These are orphan issues, and institutional capacity is just not there to deal with them.
So not only do existing institutions, in your opinion, need to adjust the way they work, but we need new institutions too. I mean, exactly how could some of these global organisations speed up or become more responsive, become more appropriately structured for today's world? What needs to happen?
Well, the reason I call the book Divided Nations is that these institutions can only be as good as the governments that run them. The old Bretton Woods institutions are effectively run by the old G7 countries, and the UN is paralyzed by the disagreements between all countries. What we really need is a radical change in the ownership structure, in other words, the management structure of these institutions to reflect the new world. Over half of economic activity is now in emerging markets, but there's a 20 or 30 year lag, it seems, in the transformation of these institutions to reflect these new realities. I think we also should recognize that simply creating new institutions is unlikely to resolve the problem. So I think we need to get into constituency politics in a much greater way. Getting 200 plus governments to agree to things is simply impossible. But if on, for example, climate change, we could have the biggest emitters together with representative groups of those affected, say Bangladesh and a couple of other countries, agreeing something, I would encourage others to sign up to that. I also think we need to accept that not everyone has to agree to things for them to happen. So if the US refuses to come to the climate change table, does that mean the rest of the world needs to wait until it gets there before it starts doing serious actions? And I think we should move ahead much more radically in Europe with China, with India, and with other players on things like climate change without necessarily insisting that we'll only do that when all the players are there.
Ian, you mentioned there the emerging economies and largely how you think many countries in the world have essentially failed to evolve. But can you not argue the other end, that these emerging economies, the BRIC countries, that they have indeed evolved, and that's why they've actually set up their very own global kind of institution in a sense?
They've evolved in many ways, and of course they've now set up the BRICS Bank, but it's tiny and incipient compared to the World Bank or other global financial institutions, for example. I think in terms of global political leadership, there's this massive gap between where they are economically, and then certainly where they are in terms of their populations relative to the scale of the world's population, and what they're doing politically. So if you ask the question, what is the leadership from the BRICS, for example, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, on finance or on climate or on cyber management or the other big issues of our time, I think the answer would be is that they are not showing global leadership on these issues.
On the other side of the scale, I mean, you suggest that these big institutions are slightly sort of lumbering, outdated, sort of big beasts of the world. At the other end of that scale, you have social networks, and plenty of people suggest that that the power of these networks is enormous and can do a lot of the work that these institutions can't quite manage. Do you think that that their ability is being overestimated?
I think they're enormously powerful. They can mobilize opinion. They can do things even in a legislative sense, as the PIPA and SOPA changes in legislation in the U.S. Indicated, where rules that had gone through the whole congressional process were reversed through online campaigns. But we need to remember that in the end, what we do need to make things happen is executive power, force regulation within countries. So the regulations on finance or the regulations on climate or the regulations in pandemics or cyber or migration and these issues, very difficult to imagine how any of those could, for example, be dealt with through social networks on their own. In the end, you need state competence, you need regulatory authority, and you need to stop free riding, which is the biggest problem in all these global commons challenges.
Ian, thanks a lot for joining us this morning. Ian Golden is Professor of Globalisation and Development at Oxford University.
In the next half hour of the programme, our culture editor Rob Bound is celebrating Record Store Day, and we'll get the news from Belgrade, and our news editor Tom Edwards takes us on a tour of the international front pages. But before all that, Paul Osborne is here with the latest news.
The new president of Venezuela has called on the country's population to come together and secure the nation's future. Nicolas Maduro was chosen by Hugo Chavez as his successor and won just under 51% of the votes. But his rival candidate, Enrique Capriles, is unhappy and demanding a recount. North Korea is marking the anniversary of the birth of its founder, Kim Il-sung. It's a day that often sees displays of military strength in Pyongyang, but the United States has led international warnings to North Korea not to add to existing tensions. Activists in Syria say 11 civilians died when government forces bombed a Kurdish village in the north of the country. They say the raid targeted the oil-rich village of Hadad. The slowdown in Europe and the United States appears to have had a knock-on effect on China's economy. It grew by 7.7% in the first 3 months of this year, still far beyond most other countries in the world, but below many analysts' predictions. And government ministers in France must declare details of their personal wealth by today. The deadline was set by the president, François Hollande, who's keen to restore public trust after the country's former budget minister was charged with tax fraud over a secret bank account. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul will be back in about 29 minutes with another check of the latest world news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It is a 10:32 in Istanbul, 9:32 in Berlin, and 8:32 in the morning here in London. Now, this week on our culture show, Rob Bound is celebrating Record Store Day, the annual occasion on which music retailers, especially those at the smaller independent specialist end of the spectrum, join hands and sing from the same set list.
Indeed, dreamed up in 2007 as a way of boosting interest and support for music retailers, the special day has gained in size and momentum like a thundering snowball made entirely of vinyl, with major names getting behind it, one-off tracks being recorded to honour it, and luxurious reissues on vinyl of classic tracks repressed in limited numbers. Now, on the show, we'll hear from record stores around the globe, but in this preview, Rob speaks to one of the head honchos of the whole day, Spencer Hickman, to find out why Record Store Day is so special.
It's just cool. I mean, it's just nice to see independent businesses working together, especially record stores, because for years everyone was like, oh, these guys don't like these guys, and there's such rivalries in there. You know, if you go to Leeds, you've got Crash and Jumbo who co-host a party after they close, and it kind of sounds corny, but it's, you know, it has brought that community together.
I thought you were going to use the phrase one love.
No.
I've used that phrase.
I wouldn't go there.
But I'm not putting those words in your mouth. No. I'm just saying it. Spencer's blushing at the very phrase. What I love. And obviously lots of stores put on gigs in store. Obviously they give out records. Special vinyl pressings are done for Record Store Day as well, aren't they? The gigs in store are always cool. You mentioned Rough Trade East. One of the big selling points for that is the in-store gigs that it's become famous for. Is this kind of more of a record store's job now to put on music as well as sell it?
I think that if you're going to go to a physical store and you're going to go shopping to buy physical, you want it to be interesting. And I think also it needs to be interesting as well, because you can go into a record store and there can just be a bunch of records there, but it's not necessarily inspiring, where, you know, you've got all these stores that are popping up, like Pie and Vinyl, who sell traditional pies and have a record shop. You know, Adrian Young in the States owns a record shop that is a hairdresser's stroke record store. So you've got these things that kind of are changing the perception of what a store can be. And I think that's the way that it's got to move forward.
It's having the records, it's displaying them nicely, it's having a what you might call a curated selection of stuff, a personal selection of stuff that is clearly maybe not the stuff that you're going to get in the Virgin in Union Square, right, in New York. It's doing that stuff, but also having some other little weird, interesting sideline.
I think that's why Rough Trade worked and works, continue to defy kind of all expectation. I think the really interesting thing with Record Store Day is that as it's grown and as it's got bigger, every year stores are kind of reporting record takings. You know, they take more on that day than they do the whole of December. So I think it's really made them think, oh, there are people out there that really love us and still value us. And I think it's kind of made them think about what they do all year round. So, you know, more stores are doing in stores. I mean, Rise have just opened a vintage clothing store upstairs. So I think it's making people think a little bit about what they're doing. But also it's got them excited again, which is, you know, great. Because for a long time, you know, talk to anyone in the media and they'd say, oh, now that the record shop's dead and, you know, physical media's finished. And, you know, it blatantly isn't.
Which is good news, which is something that we kind of shout from the rooftops on this show and on this station as well. Now, Jack White's the ambassador for Record Store Day this year. What does that sort of mean? I mean, obviously, it's great to attach such a big name to it and someone obviously that's famous, presumably having a fairly decent vinyl collection himself. But what does that kind of mean? What will he be doing? How does that work?
Well, I think really the ambassador is just a stamp of approval. And someone like Jack White, who creates the most insane vinyl and just has crazy ideas and runs with them and is, you know, world famous, is just fantastic.
It's nice to have an icon up there.
And also he's really known for his vinyl. I mean, Third Man, you know, The Vault, all of that stuff. You know, I've got that 12-inch that's a 10-inch, that's a 7-inch, and, you know, he puts records in balloons. I mean, you know, he's
You need someone like that,
aren't
you?
Yeah.
And maybe you can tell us, before we finish, a few of the sort of key releases, maybe personally or maybe that Record Store Day itself is very excited about, that are coming out this year. As we said, to begin with, there's obviously special pressings and one-off tracks recorded for the day.
There's so many. There's 500 releases this year. And, you know, they do span all genres, that's really exciting for me. So, I mean, there's a ton of, like, metal this year, which we've never really had before. So Earache are releasing the world's shortest album, which is 83 seconds long.
Excellent.
Which is pretty cool. And, I mean, the thing that I really want, even though I own it, this is where you know that you're a sad geek, is that I'm going to try and get Juice and Mary Chain, Psycho Candy, on splatter vinyl, just because it looks amazing.
Now, I presume you're in the position to be able to get one of the first pressings of that, but I don't want to
cast
any aspersions on the distribution system of Record Store Day.
I don't get any favours whatsoever.
So you're going to have to be down Selectadisc first or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, and then, you know, I mean, this is weird for me this year because it's first year. I won't have worked in a record store on that day, and it's the first year that I've released records through my label.
Yeah, which you should tell us about, because before we switched on the mics, before we had this chat, you were telling us about that and how you're sort of juggling that. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your label and the thing that you're putting out for Records today.
So I started a label called Death Waltz Recording Company. I'm like a really big soundtrack fan. And it was just something that was going to be a bit of a hobby, and it's kind of grown into something, you know, a lot bigger. And, you know, we release soundtracks on vinyl with all new artwork, posters, prints, like really fancy coloured vinyl, like tricolours and splatters. And I kind of wanted to do something for Record Store Day, but I couldn't think what would be really cool. So I managed to license a bunch of old 60s TV themes, so like Star Trek, Lost in Space, The Munsters, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And we've done I've done really crazy like glitter, black vinyl with like glitter in there and stuff, so
this is
you
the
can
sort
really
of
run
stuff.
With
this
stuff,
is amazing,
you know?
This is really nice. Yeah. And what sort of runs are these?
There are 1,000,
right? Okay,
worldwide. Okay, it's not a lot.
Who doesn't like a bit of glitter on their vinyl records? No, I do. Not so much?
Not for me, not I would say. My preference is not, but if you want to give me a glittery
vinyl.
Each to their
own. Yeah, each to their own.
Precisely.
That was Spencer Hickman speaking to Rob Bound for this week's Culture. Elsewhere on the show, we'll be talking gig posters here in London. We'll touch on television at the Cannes MIP TV conference, and we'll then swap the small screen for the silver screen at the 32nd Istanbul Film Festival. That's all tonight at 1900 London time.
That is a packed show. So is this one. You're listening to Midori House, and we will be back right after this with the news from the ground in Belgrade.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Grasse is legendary when it comes to the alchemy of perfume making. Monocle's film crew traveled to the south of France to discover a new generation inheriting these traditions and making them their own.
My first souvenirs, we were working with flowers with my sister, trying to create and invent and of course sell some perfumes from our own. So yes, it was in our DNA, but perfume is a wonderful world and we're very lucky to have that in the family.
Making Sense, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London and 9:41 in Belgrade, Serbia, which is where we're going to head next. Our man on the ground there in Belgrade is Guy Deloney, and he joins us with a fistful of stories. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Morning. Thanks very much indeed.
The aftermath of last week's mass shooting near Belgrade, how is that country recovering from that?
Well, do you know, it was a terrible shock because despite all of the conflict that we've had in this part of the world over the past couple of decades, events like this, sort of mass shootings, are extremely rare, particularly within Serbia, where you talk to people who say that, you know, the odd thing is that despite the fact that we had all this conflict in the Balkans, unless you were fighting at the front, the war didn't really touch us apart from when we were bombed by NATO in 1999. So to have this sort of event happen, 14 people died in total, is really quite upsetting for people. And it has started people talking about the gun culture in Serbia. I was extremely surprised to find that in terms of guns held per capita, Serbia ranks in the top five in the world. And now people, of course, are talking about, well, should we really be there? Should we be looking at how easy it is for people to get guns and ammunition in the light of these events?
Why is it so easy for people to get guns and ammunition? Should we be tracing that back to the conflict 20 years ago, or is it something entirely separate?
It's part of that, but you also look at the other countries in the region. There is this a culture in this part of the world which goes to places like Cyprus and Greece as well. They're among the countries which are also highly ranked in those lists. It just seems to be part of being in a country where there's agriculture, hunting. I mean, you know, if you talk about Tito, former leader of Yugoslavia, one of his great passions was hunting, and this has been one of the great passions of the nation. It's just one of those things that you've traditionally done. Having said that, there are restrictions on the amount of ammunition you can get, severe restrictions. If you've got a rifle, you're only allowed 60 rounds of ammunition a year. So, you know, some things are in place, but the police now say they want more.
And we're watching in the United States right now, the Senate there is debating tougher gun control measures. That was, of course, in the aftermath of those horrific shooting at Newtown, Connecticut. What can we expect? Can we expect in terms of a change in gun laws in where you are? Do we expect there to be tougher gun control?
It could well be. One thing which immediately struck you when there was this response to these shootings was that the chief of police has said, we're going to draft something and send it to the government on greater restrictions on access to guns and ammunition. And you thought about, well, how different that would be if it were another country like the United States, that there would be this huge outcry if anybody suggested any restrictions on gun ownership. Here in Serbia, immediately, the leaders of the country were saying it's a national tragedy. They declared a day of mourning, and we've got to do something about this to make sure it doesn't happen again, even though it's not a regular occurrence.
What about the sort of emotional aftermath of something as harrowing as that? I mean, you were saying that that really very few people, except if they're on the front line, had any experience of conflict 2 decades ago. Has there been questioning about the idea of post-traumatic stress after this?
Certainly, because the man who carried out the shootings was a veteran of the Balkan conflicts, and you know, his brother has told the media that he was never the same again after serving time during the siege of Vukovar in Croatia. So people immediately raise this idea of post-traumatic stress. And I've seen this before in conflict environments, whether people realise it or not, they can be experiencing some sort of mental difficulties on a day-to-day basis, which they basically haven't processed. I mean, in the case of Cambodia, where I used to live, for example, it was estimated that 40% of the population had some sort of mental health issue. Now, bearing in mind everything that's happened in Serbia in terms of conflict, in terms of the bombings, which NATO executed in 1999 over a lot of Serbia, there's probably a lot of unresolved trauma that hasn't been dealt with because the country doesn't have the resources to deal with those sort of psychological issues.
And Guy, moving on to another story that's caught your attention. There have been some clashes in the autonomous province of Vojvodina and some protests over the weekend as well.
Now, this is quite a difficult one to get your head around. I've been trying as best as I can, but Vojvodina is the northern province of Serbia. It's autonomous, supposedly. It has a certain amount of executive powers. It's got its own assembly. And last week, the leader of the assembly said that he was preparing a declaration of Vojvodina's rights. Now, the governing party of the Serbian government immediately took this to be some sort of push for independence. And they organized, along with a number of other political groups, a mass protest in Vojvodina's biggest city, Novi Sad, last Friday. Now, what on earth is actually going on here? Is Vojvodina actually pushing for some sort of independence? The leaders of the assembly say not. They say that the issue is being used as a smokescreen by the central government to obscure other problems in the country, like the economy and the issues that they've got over Kosovo. But it's very difficult to tell. And of course, people are concerned in Serbia that their country has already been snipped away quite a bit, and they don't want any more snipping.
Let's talk about a topic that our producer Alad is extremely excited about, and this is the arrival of his favourite artist Beyoncé to Belgrade. How much excitement is there on the ground, as much as here in the studio?
Oh, I'm sure there's vast amounts in the studio there in London, but I was speaking to the mayor of Belgrade the other day, Dragan Djilas, who's also the head of the main opposition party, the Democrats, and you'd have thought this was a man with better things to do than talk about Beyoncé, but he brought it up himself. He says this is exactly the sort of thing that we need to have happening in Belgrade, because Beyoncé's starting her world tour in Belgrade, and Dragan Djilas, a very serious man, a politician, a businessman, is saying this is going to put us on the map. Belgrade, there we are.
Is it a popular destination then for international pop stars to make a visit or even perform in Belgrade?
You know, it's been getting more so. I mean, we had J-Lo not so long ago. You've got people like Mark Knopfler and Rammstein. I mean, couldn't wait to see Rammstein at the Combank Arena in Belgrade. I mean, how incredibly... I won't use the words, but it could be awesome, couldn't it? But we've got all these international acts coming into to Belgrade now. And that is, Mayor Djilas was telling me, an important part of getting people to see Belgrade and Serbia in a different light, because, you know, people think that that Serbs are horrible in a lot of places in Europe. Getting people to open their tours here and attracting people to come and see the concerts in this country is a part of changing that image. It's soft power.
Thanks very much, Guy, and enjoy the concert indeed if you are going to be heading there tonight. Guy Delaney, thanks as ever for bringing us up to speed.
And that was the bootylicious Guy Delaunay. And on to Beyonce now. Why not? This is Single Ladies. Wow, Phil, calm down. That was Beyonce with all the single ladies.
I wish we had a webcam in this in the studio so everyone could see her dancing.
Thank you. Well, dancing harder than anyone else is our news editor, Tom Edwards.
He's going to have he's joining us now in the studio for a flick through this morning's pages. Thanks for coming into the show, Tom.
Hey, Phil. You know, it's a real pleasure to be here, as always. And Dom, I feel I shouldn't miss you out of
Please
that.
Don't.
How are you both today?
Yeah, we're very good, thanks. Great. We've been enjoying that little dance, and now let's dance through the papers. What are you going to start us off with?
Well, I've got a few stories. I've got some cougars, I've got boar, cougars. I've got some tomatoes. Where do you think I should start? Shall I start with something more serious?
Quite a bizarre shopping list.
The Independent newspaper. An interesting story in here. UK's maverick diplomat takes on a new job, a Syrian rebel's voice to the United Nations. I don't know if you remember Conor Ross, who was a senior diplomat in the Foreign Office, and he resigned after the invasion of Iraq in dispute at what he claims was misleading information. He suggests that the US and UK hadn't investigated Iraq's weapons of mass destruction adequately. He set up this, essentially his own sort of business, representing sort of little different factions around the world. And his latest client of his company, Independent Diplomat, is the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces. So he's been based at New York. He's going to basically lobby on their behalf. They were in London last week. They've been all around the world trying to sort of gain some traction internationally, get a bit of leeway, a bit more leverage with some of the big Western governments. And Conor Ross is going to help them out.
It's kind of a private diplomat for hire, by the sounds of it.
That's very much what he is.
And does he have any other, who are kind of some of his other clients?
Well, he's worked for a whole bunch of people, Phil. Let me just leaf through this. He's worked for marginalised causes in Kosovo, Somaliland, the Western Sahara. So quite a lot of these very disparate, small interests. And I think he's been pretty successful. A principled man.
Clearly.
Now he's going to try and help out the Syrians. Interesting stuff, I think.
That is exciting. You said cougars. Do you want to move on to cougars?
Do you want to do cougars?
Well, I'm intrigued by cougars.
This is in the Daily Telegraph, right, as we might have guessed.
Of course, the cougar-centric Telegraph.
Yeah. Helen McCrory, the actress.
Ah, yes.
Perhaps best known as being the wife of Damian Lewis, star of Homeland.
We're all big fans of this. She was also in Skyfall, wasn't she? She was the nasty, questioning MP there.
Well, anyway,
ruined everyone's day.
Do you know what she has to say?
Yes. No, I don't. Sorry. That's why you're here. Tell us.
She says, literature is reflecting what's happening in life. More and more women are having relationships with younger men. It's partly that women are not losing their figures. They no longer feel it inappropriate to be sexual at 40. What do you think about that, Phil?
I think... No. How do you feel about being sexual at 40? Go on.
Quite awkward by this discussion right now.
Shall I change from cougar? Let's just knock that one on the head. What about boar? We talked cougars. Should we talk boar?
Yes, please.
Tug hog.
Wild boar in ranger sites. Forest population soars. This is in the Times of London. Forest rangers are using thermal imaging cameras to estimate the number of wild boar in the Forest of Dean. Do you know why they fear there's a population explosion?
Because there are lots of cougar boars doing the rounds in the Forest of Dean.
It's not cougar boars.
If there were cougars, they would be eating the boars.
It's more frightening even than that. One of these boar was shot last year. It weighed nearly 400 pounds.
Ouch.
That's a hefty thing. Boar. There's a picture of it there. Our listeners can't see that, but he looks kind of menacing.
A handsome hog.
And do you want to know what the problems they're causing?
I'd love to.
They're causing a lot of road accidents.
Okay.
But that's not all. They also startle horses.
Of course they do.
They've been attacking dogs.
What? No.
I know, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Oh, unbelievable.
And worst of all, apparently, this is the biggest complaint, they dig for roots in fields.
Well, that's fine. What's wrong with that?
Farming community.
Oh, I see.
See, Phil, the voice of the countryside, fill the voice of the countryside Han now.
I see.
Pretty big problem. So they're going to have to cull more of them. Look, here's a picture of them scavenging for food near forest homes. They're going through bins. So
they're sort
like
of
a common fox.
They're looking like a giant pig, but behaving like a small fox.
So they've got until September.
Wild boar sausages are quite, they're quite in fashion these days. Why can't they just farm some of those, shoot a couple and then make some sausages?
Well, the big cull starts in September, Phil. So unsheath your rifle. Head down to the Forest of Dean.
Okay. Never encourage him to unsheath his rifle. Have we got any others
here? I've got another foodie story. We've been talking about sausages inadvertently there. This was a story we actually covered last week. We're talking about, I don't know if you recall me chatting with my colleague Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the soaring price of tomatoes in Brazil.
Ah, yes.
Apparently, soaring prices threatened to land Dilma Rousseff in the soup. It's a tomato soup,
if
you will.
Did you come up with that? Or are you just...
That's, I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, dear.
That's Joe Leahy in Sao Paulo. It's continuing to rise, partly seasonal, but because of inflation, and then bad weather. A number of people, they're just not happy about it. And apparently, Dilma Rousseff's going to possibly pay the price.
Oh, I see.
They're suggesting her re-election at Joe Leahy in Sao Paulo. Her re-election is being jeopardised.
Oh, my God.
By tomatoes?
By tomatoes.
She could be canned.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's actually pretty good. My initial reaction was that it was horrible, but I actually quite like that.
I think people are too derogatory about puns. You've got to respect them every now and again.
That's right. But her popularity rating's been almost up at 80%. And partly due to record low unemployment. But inflation shocks, that's not what the Brazilian public want. And this tomato crisis is just going to make them much more unhappy.
Are they turning to other veggies instead of tomatoes?
You can't, Phil, can you?
No, not really.
Do you know what I mean? If you're, especially, Italian cuisine, this is they're talking to Walter Taverna, whose restaurant is a fixture of Sao Paulo's Italian district. He says, this is the worst I've ever seen in almost half a century.
Goodness me. Tomato crisis.
Yeah.
We've probably got time to shoehorn in one story if you want.
Well, what about this for a quick? This is on the front page of The Guardian. An interesting story here. Big state Britain, UK voters' sympathy for the poor. A YouGov poll in The Guardian. Obviously, a lot of this coming off the back of Margaret Thatcher's recent demise and a lot of speculation about the damage she did or didn't wrought on society. Very interesting. As opposed to our continental friends here in the UK, in France, 47% of voters say the government is not tough enough towards people on benefit and should do more to force them into work. Similar kind of margins in Germany, the US. In Britain, it's evenly split, 36%. Some say they're too harsh. Some say they're not harsh enough. We don't have this aggressive attitude towards this problem that our continental friends
do. Which is difficult for the Conservative Party here in the UK, which has put
Absolutely.
A lot of stock behind... angering people about
these
sorts of
issues.
Well,
it's the whole Thatcherite legacy, if you will. So maybe it hasn't been so deep-rooted as
we thought. Tom, you can't bring that up with 30 seconds of the show left.
Well, I'd like to leave you a challenge, Tom.
Well, I'm not going to take it up. Monocle's news editor is Tom Edwards. Thanks very much. And that is all we have time for today. Our show was produced by Alid John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Amelia Jen and Barbara Feeney. Sam Impey was the studio manager. We'll both be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But after the news, our editor Andrew Tuck will be here with the latest edition of The Urbanist. Thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.